Hey, Coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Hey, Coach, I'm excited to announce a brand new way to access our resources to elevate your coaching monthly memberships. At Basketball Immersion, we know every coach's journey is unique, just like your player's skill sets. That's why we're dedicated to providing you with the flexibility you crave. Our new monthly access plan lets you get full access to all our videos and courses on a month-to-month basis, giving you the freedom to cancel or renew as needed. Whether you're just starting out or looking to add some fresh perspectives to your existing coaching repertoire, Basketball Immersion has the resources to help you reach your goals. Head over to basketballimmersion.com to take control of your coaching journey and unlock your full potential with Basketball Immersion.
Awesome to welcome back to the Basketball Podcast, Penn State Assistant Coach Joe Crispin. Crispin last appeared on episode 247, and his Immersion Videos product, All Access Practice with Joe Crispin, has become a bestseller as coaches learn about his play-based philosophy from raw and real practices. One of Penn State's all-time great players and longtime professional player, Crispin just completed his first season as assistant to the head coach at Penn State. Crispin spent the last seven seasons as the head men's basketball coach at Rowan University, where he guided the team to 114-54 record, three NCAA tournament appearances, two conference titles, and the 2023 Sweet 16. He collected the fourth most wins by head coach in school history through his 7 years on the sideline. Crispin engineered one of the most prolific offenses in the country at Rowan, as the team averaged more than 80 points per game in each of his final six seasons, including 90-plus points per game in each of his last 2 years. Learn more about Joe and his philosophy at www.joecrispinbasketball.com. Joe, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited for this, and I fortunately get a chance to talk a little bit. And what's it like to be back at Penn State now as a coach?
It's home, and I like to say I'm a better soldier when I'm fighting for home. So I like to think I'm better being here than I am anywhere else. That's how I felt where I was before, but it was about this time last year that it took Mike Rhodes about a 45-minute phone call max and one question: would you be interested in coming back? For me to go, oh, yeah, I definitely would be. So those things happen quickly. I think I resigned within 24 hours, and it's unexpected, but a great unexpected. And fortunately, my wife was all over the world with me, so there's not much that can surprise her, but she also played soccer here at Penn State. It made it about as easy a transition as you possibly could find when in terms of life, even though with five kids, nothing's easy.
Nothing's easy. And you've been on the podcast before, and certainly a lot of people know your story, but former great college player, professional player, moved into coaching with a philosophy that probably now we would define as more modern, in the sense that everything that you do is focused on player enjoyment and what we would call transfer from practice to games, so that it actually helps them from a technique and tactic perspective in the games. Give us just a broad overview for those that haven't heard you before about your journey and then your place in the basketball space where you've shared so much good stuff like this.
I think we covered maybe some of it before, but I think even just in the last time that we spoke here on this podcast, some things have become apparent to me that have made me pretty different compared to most people in my situation. One thing that I've often returned to over and over, I tell people from 96 to 2000, I might as well have been on a spaceship. I was not involved in AAU basketball. I didn't even know what it was. I would help out with a camp and play with my own kids. And then I was over in Europe focused on my own career. And the second thing is, I've always been a questioner. I played the game in a contrary way, right? Everyone says you can't shoot that many threes. And in hindsight, I probably should have shot more. And I would say why. I was always a why person. Probably drove many a coach crazy. And I like to tell people, I don't recommend living this way anyway. It's not always fun living with myself because I'm constantly questioning everything, including some of my own decisions. But those two things add up to just a different perspective, not just from a teaching component, but just this basketball world that we live in. I wasn't a fish swimming in the same waters that many people were swimming in. And then I launch into coaching, one, coaching college players at the Division III level, and then two, coaching kids, which was an accident of sorts. People just asking me to do stuff. And naturally, I'm not someone who just willy-nilly, sure, I'll do something. I go all in and research it and think about it. And even though I had been preparing to coach, the the methodology was something that really happened more organically than it did anything else, because I was just trying to be the coach that I always wanted to play for at the college level. And then I was trying to be someone who made my own kids and his friends better, their friends better. And then I realized you and everyone else have great terminology for all the stuff that we were, and justification for what we were doing.
Intuitively, playing basketball to get better at basketball made sense to you. And then obviously, again, if I've done anything in the landscape, it's added some credibility to that from a evidence-based perspective and experiential-based perspective. But most of your initial thrust into this space was experiential, saying, why are we doing this as a player? This doesn't help me get better and doesn't help our team win.
Yeah, and a lot of it was based on my own experience. I was fortunate enough to really have a great education growing up. I had, my father was a coach, my grandfather was a coach, my uncle was a coach, I lived in gyms. Even my dad and grandfather, my grandfather was pretty intense, both of them were intense, but I remember growing up watching my dad coach high school basketball, sitting down a lot during the game. That stood out to me. And his perspective was, what are we doing in practice? If we're doing what we want to do in practice, then these guys should be prepared for the game. And I never forgot that. But the second thing is, when I got into the youth stuff and then into college and saw the corollary between some of the different things that were being done at the youth level and how I had to adjust as a college coach, I realized that when all my playing growing up in such a variety, diverse settings, I would read about education. I like to say that I didn't love school, but I loved learning, especially as I got older and realized, wow, we talk about a liberal arts education in terms of school and what a benefit that is. What about a liberal arts education in basketball? And we've now grabbed onto all that, and we want to control this whole process, and then we don't like the result in the end, or the college coaches like myself don't like the result in the end. And there's a disconnect between what we're doing at a youth level and then what we're doing here. When you want to win and you're a questioner, you're going to figure out why it is this way and what we can do better. And probably the biggest thing that stood out to me was if these kids have grown up differently, I can't just assume the same things my college coach could assume or my dad could assume when he was coaching us. And I have to adjust and give them the foundation that essentially was given to me more organically.
So talk to us first about what you feel is the disconnect between, say, youth basketball development right now and what's happening at your level or what you want to have happen at your level.
Yeah, the story I often tell is I remember being on a Friday night at a recruiting event and watching games and talking to coaches. A lot of times you just spend the time talking to coaches and hearing the complaints, a lot of the same complaints, like kids lack instincts, kids lack the ability to adjust to a variety of settings, maybe leadership skills, whatever it is. And then the very next day, coaching fifth and sixth graders in some no-name gym in South Jersey and realizing, wait a second, last night I was one of the few people in the gym who spend a good deal of time coaching young kids and going to these crazy youth environments. And then today, I'm probably the only person in this gym who knows where this ends, right? Everyone else is just in the midst of working with kids and trying to win a weekend. And that was very early on in my time at Rowan. I realized, wait a second, I don't know what's being done here. And there's a clear connection to the complaints that we're doing the night before or the night after about our college players and what they lack. And the two things I often come back to is just, one is instincts. And instincts, when we talk about instincts, aren't just about basketball instincts, though that's included. Right. But it's also about the instinctual idea of fitting into a team and playing a role and just being comfortable in any basketball environment. Right. This is something that I've heard from college coaches from the moment I got into things, was that the kids lack this. And to me, it's no wonder why, because increasingly kids are playing in the same basketball role weekend after weekend, year after year. And we're creating them to be specialists rather than generalists moving to a specialist situation, right? So they really don't know how to be a point guard who needs to pass first one day like I did when I was with the old guys on the playground, right? If you shot too much and you were the little eighth grader playing with the guys, you got yelled at and then you weren't going to stay on the court. That's how I learned I had to be a pass first point guard. People don't realize that I actually have done that and could do that because they remember all the threes I shot. But I learned instinctively, if I want to stay on this playground, I need to play better defense and I need to fit in and make the extra pass or box out and rebound because I want to keep playing. I didn't grow up in just the same situation week after week, year after year, where I was the best player on the court or the specialist shooter on the wing. I played in every basketball scenario, and I felt like that prepared me to be successful, especially in the professional ranks, where it's as much about survival as it is about thriving and being your best self, right? It's just, no, how can I contribute to this team in order to get this next job? And I think from an instinctual standpoint, educationally, our system and all its specialties and money and everything else is severely lacking in that skill. And it's an interpersonal skill. It's a relational skill. It's a feel thing that comes through varieties of situations and play. And I often tell parents, I told a parent just the other day, like, find a situation where your kid's the best on the court, where he's the worst on the court, and everywhere in between. That's going to help him, right? And that's really hard to find today. And then we wonder why the transfer portal's got thousands of names. No, it's no wonder. We've been doing this since they were in third or fourth grade.
100%. You and I have both talked a lot offline about youth coaching, and we're both in those spaces, or have been in those spaces extensively. But I want to come back to one thing that you said about coaches. And again, higher level coaches, they're saying players don't have basketball IQs. But then when you go to their practices, they're doing drills where there's no decisions. Yep. To me, there's still a disconnect between understanding, and you alluded to this, how players need to be coached nowadays, because the times are different. And the times are different, particularly around the fact that you and I would go play pickup. Yep. Whereas kids nowadays, not to their fault, but the kids nowadays, everything is structured. Like, I have to create unstructured moments in my practices for my daughter's AAU teams to play basketball without being coached.
Yep.
And that just doesn't happen anymore, does it?
No. And one of the stories I often refer to was actually a baseball story. I'll never forget, my son was playing baseball and the first baseman was a 12-year-old in Little League. And the ball went past him. I think there was a runner on first. And the ball goes past him, bad throw, whatever. And he goes and gets the ball, and the first place he looks is to second. There's a guy running in third, and he scores a run. And my son's coach, I'm sitting there talking to him, was pulling his hair out, right? And what I said to him is, he's, what in the world? I don't even know what to do with that, right? And it's the same thing in basketball. But what I said to him was, him and I did not learn that guy was rounding third from our little league coach. We learned that from each other and playing wiffle ball, in playing pickup baseball. And probably the best way we learned it is when we messed it up in our little Kindle school playground, one of our older friends yelled at us and, yo, I'm not putting you at first base anymore if you don't know that. When they do that, you're like, whoa, I'm going to remember that next time, right? That's ingrained in our brain. Where did that happen? It happened way far away from adults. And if kids don't grow up with that, then we have to adjust at the college level. And that includes this level. It's every single level to introduce the things that we want to teach and the things that we want them to learn. And if they lack them, we got to do the best we can to make up for it. And one of the things I mentioned to you, in particular with my role here being predominantly focused on offense, even though I do love defense way more than people think, but it was usually, I like to say, our defense at Rome was as much about our offense as it was about our defense, but that's another conversation, the connection between those two ends. But when we talk about decision-making and comfort and chaos and all these different things, what we mentioned is just even the idea of rhythm, flow, what we call logging the game, of just an understanding and a feel for the difference between you can shoot that, but that doesn't mean you should shoot that. And there's a ton of nuance and gray area there of, hey, yeah, I don't mind that shot after you just made one or two, or I don't mind that shot after we just had a couple good possessions and a good defensive stop. But that same shot in a different context, I do mind, and it's terrible, right? And that idea is something that you have to learn, I think, organically through playing actual games and getting feedback. And that's a thing that's really sorely lacking, even to the point where I talk about our AAU culture. Something as simple from an offensive standpoint as bonus. A lot of these weekend games, you get 10 fouls or whatever, and you're not playing with the bonus. Playing with the bonus is a primary idea in my mind. How many fouls do they have? How many fouls do we have? Who's in foul trouble? Who can I attack? That doesn't matter most weekends. And then they come to college, and let alone the shot clock. Don't get me started on that. We'll never end. But we come to college, and then we wonder why they don't realize, our own guys might not realize, hey, they have five team fouls. We better not shoot four straight threes, right? Because if we attack the rim enough times, we're going to get to the free throw line. We're going to put ourselves in the bonus. We're going to put this guy on the bench. That's a whole different game we're playing that in the AAU I played, where they weren't concerned about rushing you off the court within an hour. That game was in play. And nowadays it's not. So there's a lot going on there that I just gave you for more talking points.
So many talking points. But to me, to summarize it, is this concept of problem solving. Is that too often as coaches, we are solving the problems for players so they don't know how to solve their own. That relates to what you just talked about bonus. Yeah, I agree with you. AAU, there's no prep because it's runtime, all this stuff. We could have a whole conversation. But it doesn't prepare a player for a lot of those game situations. But just in general, our practices are spoon-feeding players answers, whereas the game doesn't give them the answers. So they have to figure it out. And every part of your philosophy connects with this concept, which is figure it out. We're going to put you in situations and you need to figure it out. And then with that, educating them with these questions, right? And you started with why. Talk to us more about using questions to be able to help players develop problem solving.
I think if you go back to that, and I'll address that, the question aspect of things, but one of our commitments here, when I first sat down with Coach, like, we knew we were on the same wavelength in terms of what he wanted to do and offensively playing a little faster. And one of our foundational convictions is we need to create better playmakers first, right? Guys who can make decisions, because the national championship game was last night, just in terms of timing. And it's even everyone gets in love with cool action. It's cool. And I always joke, I'm like, listen, these people, everyone posts their cool actions that work. And I'm like, yeah, there's 28 other times that didn't work, by the way, but only the ones that work go on Twitter. And I'm like, anybody's guilty of that. It's the only made shots go on Twitter. But there was like 10 other times that it didn't work. And the percentage wise wasn't as high as we think. But even regardless of what you run, at the end of the thing is a dude making a play. He's making a read and a decision, and he's bumping the guy at the right time. And there's all this nuance involved in it. And one of our big things that Coach and I talked about was like, let's do all we can to create those kind of players, where we want to be a players making plays place more than just a plays making plays place. Now, I think even plays end with a player making a play. But when you get into when you talk about the question aspect of things and rhythm and flow, I think one of the biggest things that is underestimated today, right, for a variety of reasons, from a coaching standpoint, if you're a high school coach and you don't have a shot clock, you probably don't need to ask this question enough. A shot clock would force you to ask this question, is let's zoom out and let's focus more on the bigger picture of the game itself. I think a lot of times this is true offensively and defensively. We can prepare our players without regard to context. And one of the things that we try to explain to our guys and remind ourselves as coaching is that discipline is typically very contextual. I say it's contextually dependent, right? So, you know, this is something that I've talked about for years, is that when we talk about the discipline of shot selection, for example, or the discipline of jump stop or footwork or whatever, a kid could have a great footwork in a half court setting when he catches the ball in a predictable situation. He could jab step and cross over, and he's never going to get called for a travel, and his pivot foot doesn't move. The moment you put him in transition and he runs to the same spot he travels, then that discipline is contextually dependent. It's the context of half court, and he's probably only worked on it in the half court. Therefore, what do we need to do? We need to put him in that situation so that he's jabbing and crossing over and pump faking in transition if we're a transition team. Or if we're not, he's going to end up into it anyway. But the second thing is the discipline of shot selection is contextually dependent, in that you need to constantly be putting your players in the context of a game, right? Especially if you want to play fast, so that they can learn and you can hold on here. What did you think about that last possession? How much time is left? What's the situation? What just happened the two possessions before that, right? These questions should always be going through our minds. They're not going through your players' minds. They're not even there. So if you're not asking them consistently, right, they're not going to learn it. If you're not playing in a semi-game-like situation, which again, depends on your game, right? Our game has 90,000 TV timeouts. So we have, there's another thing, like we have TV timeouts. We have stoppages of play that are completely and radically unrelated to the game itself. We have to plan for that. And we have to practice a little differently than I might at Rowan, where I didn't have TV timeouts, right? Those things matter. And then you can teach in the midst of that context. But if you remove them from the context, you can't complain when they don't apply that information in the flow of a game that's completely different than our practices.
Thank you for saying all that. Because one of the issues I have in this space now, this game-based space, whatever people want to call it, is I think there's too many people telling other people they're wrong when, without giving them any ideas about what are actually the solutions to be able to help things be better. And what you just outlined there is a real simple thing that all coaches can apply however you practice, which is literally stopping them in context and asking them questions instead of giving them answers.
And there's a ton of clumsiness in that, right?
Messy beyond. And it's uncomfortable, yes. Isn't it?
Yes. But it's still very coachable, right? It's still very possible. And I think a lot of times what people fail to realize is the mistakes that are inevitable, you want them to happen as much away from the crowd as possible, right? Now, when the crowd comes and the game's real and there's keeping score and there's everything being on TV and whatever, it is much harder to put up with those mistakes, understandably. But even then, we have to pick and choose our spots to say, all right, what games are probably more winnable that we can make some of these mistakes and put up with some of these mistakes so that we can become better later on in the season, right?
Can I just stop you there? Because one thing that I know we agree on is, was it actually a mistake, or was it just a decision that was different than your decision that you think was right as a coach?
Yes, that's right. And a lot of times that's where I think the benefit is that a good shot? And I used to do this with our guys, and we still do this with our guys here. Is it a good shot? There's usually two answers, right? One is, it's not a turnover. That's one we often say. We use that a lot. I often hesitate to say that because I think it's such a secret to keeping our turnovers low. It is a shot. There's a lot we can do with a shot that we can't do with a thing that's not a shot. But the second thing is, it depends, right? I don't know. Did you feel good? Did you take it with your whole heart? And if the kid says no, then I say, then it's a bad shot, period. If you didn't take that with every fiber of your being, with crazy confidence to say, yeah, I got this. I don't give a rip if coach thinks this is a good shot or not. I'm taking this, right? I live my life that way. So if you didn't take it that way, then your percentage is way lower than you think. So you're in the context too, your confidence, your feel, your flow, whatever. I'm like, all right, you took that. All right, I can live with that. And then the other part of it is like, all right, what's happened before? What's happened after? It's not the worst. Maybe it's not the best. Here are just some things to consider. So that it is a judgment. I think a judgment-free zone in some respects is good. And rather than hopping on the emotional train where it's, that's a terrible shot. I always tell my brother who's in broadcasting, don't be that guy. Don't be that guy. Because, you know, who said that, right? There's a lot more nuance to that. And maybe the way the game is, maybe there's, and crazy, at our level, are we in the bonus? Is there a TV timeout coming? There's a lot of different stuff involved in answer to that question. And the more you can educate your players on that, or go a step further interrelationally. Oh boy, over here, your teammate just hit two in a row. And then you thought it was a good time to jack up an NBA three? No, look out for your guy. You wouldn't like him doing that to you. And then most players know that. Most players realize, yeah, fair point. Can't argue with that at all. And they learn from it.
Context specific, it depends. That applies to a lot of the way you coach within a game-based philosophy. And then the part that really connects for me about what you said, even about that player feeling like, oh, they felt like it was a good shot versus they weren't quite all in on the shot comes back to psychological safety, this buzzword that exists nowadays. But it's players feel safe the more experiences they have and the more interactions you have where you co-create solutions rather than just tell them they're right or wrong. And that applies to how you coach, doesn't it?
Yeah. And a lot of times, to your point, like there's not a clear answer, but the shot, I love the idea of shot selection, right? Is I used to always tell our guys, and still we say this here, is the only shot you're definitely not allowed to shoot is the one you're not sure about, right? Because the moment you introduce uncertainty to the mix, your percentage is going to go down. But the other component to that is like there, it is dependent on your style of play. There are ways to play that make your players more dangerous. And there are ways to play that and dangerous both to yourself and your opponents, right? Because you put them in an aggressive frame of mind and they're not afraid to take risks. Sometimes that can hurt you. Sometimes you can burn yourself with that, but a lot of times it's very dangerous to your opponents. It's unpredictable. And we could talk a little bit about that balance between structure and freedom. But the other component to that is, where was I headed with that? Yeah, the idea is that from a contextual standpoint, it depends how you want to play. How fast do you want to play, right? What is your commitment, right? What is your commitment to your identity from an offensive standpoint, from a defensive standpoint? And teaching kids that, hey, this is what we say we stand for. This is why, right? Connect it to the larger picture of style of play. This is what we say we're committed to. Yeah, it might not be the best shot, but for us, it's good. It's fine because we want to play a little bit faster. Or, hey, we want to be a little more methodical. We got to set up more set plays. And for whatever reason, that's not my preference, but there's possibilities there. Or, hey, we have a great player that we haven't gotten involved three straight possessions. So the coach does want to take the reins in a little bit to help the players without being a complete crutch. All those things are possible and all of them are teaching, but they all relate to the bigger picture of what our actual commitments and constraints are from a philosophical perspective.
From watching your Rowan praxis, it really stands out and it confirms it's what my praxis would look like too. And they do look is sometimes people misconstrue the way that you're coaching is not coaching. And that comes back to that question that you said, this difference between freedom and structure and that concept. But first, maybe let's just address that you are coaching. And what does that look like for people that haven't seen you run this type of practice?
Yeah, I think the example I often tell, especially when I was running a bunch of youth stuff, I would say to parents, listen, sometimes I would write these things to parents. I would say, I could impress you more with my coaching, air quotes, coaching, in my organizational skills. I had kids in line and I got whistles and we got cones and we got order and we got this and we got jump stops and we got pivots and we got all this other stuff. And you would be like, wow, this guy is a master, right? And I've done that before. Right. And sometimes there might be a little 10-minute segment. I do it just to get kids in order and get them all look focused on what I'm doing or whatever. But then I would explain to them, I'm going to work on all those same things in a very messy, contextually dependent way. I'm going to empower older kids to help organize some of the younger kids or the kids who are more familiar with what's being done to teach each other within a station. Right. A lot of times they were my own kids and I would tell my own sons, yo, why is this not organized right here? How come your boy doesn't know what he's doing? Teach him, show him, because the best way for you to learn is to teach it. And then sometimes the best way for him to learn is for you to teach it, not me, right? And he sees someone in front of him doing it and you create all this messiness within practice and you might stop it and say, hold on, what just happened here in a 5-on-5 context, right? In a college situation, but maybe a youth situation. We'll do that here. Whoa. Time out. Did you like how that felt? Did you see that? That was three quick passes, decisions. We created imbalance. We attacked open space. You used your pivot foot. That was beautiful. So now you're reinforcing certain things. But to your point, it's harder for parents to be impressed. I actually had a parent who was a basketball girl I knew growing up, and she was at one of our camps, and the kids are going through these stations. And I was pointing out to her like, yeah, this station's for horns reads and the kids aren't allowed to switch. And then this kid, they got a 1-second ball clock. And then over here, this is an advantage game. And she was like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. I said, what did you think they were doing? Just running around playing? And she goes, that's what it looks like. And I said, you know what? I'm glad you told me that because I forget. That is what it looks like right now. It looks like I just rolled the balls out and put no thought into these stations.
I have to say, just like from doing camps and clinics around the world, the first thing I do, and I've learned this over the years, I didn't do this at the beginning, is exactly what you just said. I give a disclaimer to all the parents and players and explain, this is what you're seeing. This is why we're doing it. I just posted a blog on this, in fact, too, with an example, because they don't know what they don't know.
No,
they do know what they used to do or what they saw before, which is organization drills. Everything's perfectly in place.
Yeah. And I think, like, even when we would do stations, like, we would have some things where maybe it was obvious what we were trying to teach them, right? Maybe from a young kids, and you're teaching them how to certain footwork on a pivot or certain jab step series or whatever. I still have room for that. But that doesn't mean what a lot of people and coaches often think, especially young coaches, is they think, let me control this process and teach them immediately. It doesn't work that way, right? None of us work. Even those things require a certain degree of clumsiness and messiness to say, no, relax, give them a couple days here to try to tinker with this and they'll figure it out. Or if they're coming once or twice a week, we'll keep working on it. They don't need to get it right now, right? I don't know. Is there a rush? Was there somebody here that I didn't know about? And that's something too that I think we talked about before, is just, I don't think we can do enough parental education, right? And I think you do a great job of that and encourage coaches to do a great job of that. But even from a just teaching place for youth coaches, is if you're learning something, pass it on, right? Pass it on to parents. In my experience, parents really do want to know. And a lot of times they're paying for something, so then they really want to know. And now that I'm here, I get to do less of it at the youth, almost none of it at the youth level, unless we're running camps, which is a whole nother. I don't understand that in our system. The people most invested in basketball can do the least, but that's another matter. Doesn't
I
make
just
any
wrote
sense
a blog on this too, about how we have to re-envision camps. And it comes back to the point that you started with, which is, why are we doing something from 30 years ago the same way we're doing it today when kids are different? They learn differently. You and I could not go on our phone and learn how to make moves on our own and learn these moves and go apply them on air by themselves. They need camps to be able to go play basketball. But we go to camps and we make them do all these line drills and stuff again.
Yeah, I've talked to multiple people just even this spring, some coaches and their high school coaches, middle school coaches. And when I explained what we were doing in the summers with kids and just how that was a time to play and experiment, I talked to Coach Martelli actually a couple weeks ago, because he's moving on from Michigan and headed back to Philly. And he was saying all these same things of just the need to play. And then we even talked about it. And this is like a whole nother topic I think coaches are aware of, but I don't think they realize how important it is, the interrelational aspect of things. When we were growing up, if we wanted to play basketball, I hopped on my bike and I rode around the neighborhood to say, can you play? I was the general manager, right? I was the president of operations and I was the coach. Say, this is what we're going to do. And I had to convince my friends of, like, okay, you don't want to play basketball, but all right, we'll play basketball, then we'll play football. And then all these negotiation skills and all these different things. Now, my kids don't have that opportunity. They're not even home on Saturday. They're at the dumb AAU tournament where all the adults are telling them what to do. And again, I do that. I was there. Drives me crazy, but I'm there because there's not a whole lot of other options. But that aspect of leadership development and being a general manager and organizing your guys and your friends to say, this is how we're going to play. Okay, the team stink. Let's switch them. All these different things that we grew up. If these kids haven't grown up this way, you can't just skip those steps, right? Even when you get to our level, right? A high level Division I level, we have to help them with these things. We have to help them learn how to communicate with each other and learn that it's okay. Yeah, you disagree and you might have fought it out a little bit.
Let's give coaches some practical things, because you said one of them, which is, like, literally I would never make teams. I'd never make teams. Like, sometimes you come into practice, you want specific matchups, you say, hey, these matchups have to be here, but make your teams. Another one you just said, which is said, stop it and say, hey, listen, you're down five. You get to trade. You get to make a trade. Figure it
out, right?
These things, they used to happen organically. They don't anymore. Can you give us some more examples of things like that used to do within your practices?
Yeah, I think making teams is one. I think something as simple, let's just take a couple interrelational things. Like, one is, particularly at Rowan, when I first got started and we were trying to build the program, our second year was really tough, like really tough. I brought in probably three Division II transfers. couple of them at least were not in love with basketball anymore. Like they didn't, they were just burned out already after all this stuff and they had a negative experience. They didn't even know if they wanted to keep playing. Our practices weren't always the best. And I always believed that there was a gap between what we wanted it to be and what it was. And what I realized in that season in particular was that all these kids were looking to me to constantly fill that gap. And I meant emotionally, technically, all of it. It was like, there's a gap between we say we want to win a championship and this is where we are. Whose job is it to fill that gap? I grew up, even at this level and playing at Penn State or in high school, I had a really strong coach, but there was still a ton of just, yeah, this is our team. This is us, right? And if it's not good enough, then we're going to make it better, right? And if I use the example, like at Penn State, when I was a player, we would organize pickup. And if somebody was jacking around, I'd send them home. Get out of here. We're not playing with you. We'll pick up this high school kid from the IM before we play with you because you're acting like a jerk today. We'll call you tomorrow. Kids would be mortified to do that today. They might not even know how to organize pickup, right? The making teams, the calling of fouls, right? Think about the simple act of calling a foul in a playground. That is when these kids don't understand that today, but a lot of times they won't call fouls because it's like they're afraid that somebody might object. Yeah. That you got to put up a fight for yourself to say, no, I'm not calling every foul, but that was ridiculous. And we're not going there, right? There's an assertion of your will in that moment that I don't know how you learn that any other way. But to return back to that Rowan gap is I remember saying to our key guys after that season, we wanted to win it. They wanted to win a championship next year, right? Both of whom are in coaching right now. Rob and Nick DePersia, great leaders. I said, listen, one of the things I've realized, I'm reading books about it. Why is this the way it is? What is going on? I'm only 3 or 4 years into coaching, period. And I realized you have grown up with all the adults in the room filling the gap. I did not grow up that way. So I'm looking at you like, why don't you fill the gap? If practice isn't good enough, you want me to constantly hoot and holler? I'm just going to be exhausted and we're not going to win that many games anyway. So that's not how you win a championship. And I remember when I explained that to them, they were like, okay. I got it. I said, you need to be gap fillers. If you want to win the championship in the game and the emotion's down and we're on the road, you have to be the one to fill the gap, not me. That's not how teams win championships, right? Players win in those moments. Players gather around their teammates in those moments. I can help you, but if it's all me, I'm going to be exhausted and we're probably going to lose. And they embraced that. And as a group, they embraced that. But the key to that was I had to leave the gap. I couldn't just constantly fill it. And the temptation when you're in a high pressure situation and you feel a sense of urgency is to constantly fill that gap. And that's something as simple as, do you want to run this back in practice? We just played a 4-minute game, white one. Do you want to run it back? Yes, we want to run it back. Same teams? Yes, same teams. That gives away ownership. That's a simple little thing that can make a big difference in the competitive atmosphere of your practice. Another one is as simple as saying, and this is what I would do in practice. We would just say, is this good enough for you? Remember where you want to get to. And this is more of like an intrinsic motivation thing of, let's clarify, you said you wanted this. You said you wanted to win a championship. You said you wanted to turn around this program. Is this good enough to achieve that? Right, if the answer is no, then what are you going to do about it? Right? Because we could just call it a day, or you could turn this around because it's going to happen in a game. We're not going to have it that day. There's another philosophical thing. Don't just prepare for the way you want things to be. Prepare for what will happen. So I don't want that kid to shoot a step back fadeaway necessarily, but he gets the ball with 4 or 5 seconds left on the clock. He's going to shoot a step back fadeaway. We might as well practice that move. We might as well play one-on-one with him in that context. And that goes back to all this experiential stuff.
And self-exploration and the different parts that really, again, connect joy to playing the game, which is something that I know you value. And it surprises people a little bit, but one of my biggest challenges with AAU and the system that I am seeing within youth basketball experiences for my daughters is actually the lack of structure on the court. And people would think of you and I as, oh, just let them play. But that's not who we are. Like, structure gives them freedom.
Yep.
Now, a lot of people just, it's structure and don't do anything different. You just have to run that structure. But for you and I, when we talk about structure, it actually is a platform for freedom. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. We talked about there's varying degrees of structure based on what you want to teach kids, right? I think we talked about this before in terms of language learning. That's the same dynamic all the way up through the pros or this level at a high Division I level with some really good playmakers or players. Degrees of structure are often important. So even at the youth level, I've told a lot of guys, I think one thing that's often underestimated is the reason we see a lot of difficulty for good positive structure is because of overcommitment or the inability to get everyone in the same gym at the same time. And I don't mean, yeah, it's a legitimate problem, but something that we did at the youth level that was very helpful. And we used to run, essentially, we'd start the season with the same thing. And we did it in the off season here, was just two basic organizing principles, right? One, when you pass, you must do something other than stand, right? We started this simple, even here, right? You're going to pass, you can cut, or you can ghost. That's it. That makes all five players move and be dynamic and respond, right? That's one simple organizing principle. And the second is you can't hold onto the ball more than 3 seconds. That puts a certain amount of structure into a very playmaking environment. Right. In what I would often tell people is I could take any 10 individuals right now, introduce those two principles, those two constraints, and you would think we're running an emotion offense because we are.
Because those are principles of play that they have to adhere to no matter what you're doing. So it supersedes anything else, right?
Yes. But to them, they have a ton of freedom. I could set a ball screen. I could go screen. I could cut away. I could cut towards the ball. I used to tell you, you can spin around in circles for all you want. You just can't stand. And what we would do in practice is if you stand, and again, we've done this at this level, if you stand, it's a turnover. Boop, blow the whistle, turnover. That's still a minimal amount of structure that can lead to a great amount of freedom and great problem solving and great skill development and all these different things. I still think on the other hand, if you can have kids in the gym enough times, something as simple as a circle motion offense at the youth level is super helpful. Like almost it's like a modern day flex, right? I didn't love the flex offense in high school, but we didn't run it, at least when I got to high school. My friends would say before I got to high school, it was very restrictive because coach was like, you're going to do this and that's it. Understandably, because they weren't very good. But then we got a ball handler and then I could freelance a little bit and then we could make reads within that structure. That's a great way to learn language, off ball movement, when to cut, when not to cut, when to curl, how to read screens. That as long as you're not too rigid with it, as long as you're not like, you have to do it this way only at the same time, if you give them that base and then teach them the reads off that base, now you're teaching. Now you're using a structure that promotes freedom and decision-making, but it also promotes like the things you want them to learn, right? Being better movers off the ball, making, and there's going to be clumsiness in that, right?
It also gives them a spacing template, which is the most important part, right?
That's right.
And I'll just give you a quick example. Teach flex, sure, memorize the pattern. And then I would tell them, okay, now let's never run the pattern.
Yep. That's right.
And they know an offense and it's adhering to your principles of play. The other part, just to want to quickly connect for people, when you give them those principles of play, those two things, now as a coach, you are freer because you are coaching those principles of play. You're not trying to coach 1,000 things. You're coaching those principles of play. Talk to us a little bit about that process.
Yeah, that's something that we've really actually honed in on this year at Penn State, right? One, we created, and Coach was great on this, of just creating a shared language, right? Which is really important. That's an underestimated thing. That's something even I underestimated as a coach that I've learned a lot from him, is creating a shared language so that when we tell you we want to look for something, a specific action, let's say, or a cut or off our ball screen, we set a ton of ball screens, we would say, hey, based on how they're going to defend, we want as many of these kind of cuts and whatever, these kind of actions as possible. We weren't overloading them with 10 different options. We were saying there's two different options. That's it. We just want these two options within your brain. The base of movement is already there, right? But the options based on what the defense is going to do are now just, there's two things in your brain and you need to apply these two things. And then we would hold them to that standard, right? That's a way of introducing a constraint while also being unpredictable, right? And at this level, I think this is something that's important for people to understand, because at different levels, certain things could work at one level that are just a joke at another, right? We all know that. At the Division I level, the professional level, more often than not, like, teams are going to know your stuff and they're going to guard your stuff. So where you're left, where you leave yourself after it doesn't work is the most important thing about it. Or if you can find a way to be consistent yourselves, right? To be ordered yourselves, but in a way that presents itself as disorder, you now make yourself all the more dangerous, right? A motion offense in that regard, when I use those principles of a 3-second ball clock, can't pass and stand, that will present itself as disorder, but it's not to the players involved because there's those organizing principles, right? I always laugh and listen, there's, that doesn't mean there's not room for sets and structure like we talk about, but if you want to be a team that is dangerous, if you want to be a team that's dynamic and can tap into its own flow and rhythm, and then also flexible enough that when you sub in two different guys that are different than the two guys you just subbed out, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. If you want to be that kind of team, or at the young levels to develop those kind of players, then you need to keep your principles very clear, develop your own language, and then apply as you see fit based on your opponents.
So I want to bring this, I love all this. I love how we're sharing practical ideas for coaches to be able to incorporate that, whatever the philosophy that they coach with, these things can be applied. That's the beautiful thing. You don't have to be all game-based. You don't have to be all drill-based. It's, you've coached long enough and played long enough that it's a combination of a lot of things, isn't it?
Yep.
The thing I want to bring home is what you've talked about here, and maybe first get your thoughts. Why do players struggle with flow? And then how can we help them?
Yeah, I think the first answer to me is that they've grown up in too limited environments, right? They've been too limited for a long time, right? And essentially that the coaches have done the thinking for them. At growing up, and literally like 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade, like there's been minimal ability to venture outside of bounds, because to understand your boundaries requires that you pass the boundaries at times. And then you reel them back in and you go, yeah, I know you just made, I always say that my kids are pretty, they're not shy with their jumpers. And I'd always say, listen, that's great. You made two in a row, but two in a row doesn't mean you take a stupid one. It doesn't give you the right to be dumb all of a sudden, right? But if you're never allowed to be dumb, how do you learn how to, that what is actually aggressive and smart, right? If we create a pathway that we call aggressive and on one side is stupid, on the other side is conservative, right? They're, you could fall off the horse either way. The road could be different sizes for different people, right? Different players and different teams. Growing up, I think a lot of kids have not been allowed to transgress the boundaries. And I think that hurts them, because when you let them go more, they're like, whoa, are you sure about this? Yeah, we're sure about this. It's an aggressive way to play. It's a good shot, right? I know you've grown up and it's not been a good shot because you were playing in a scarce basketball environment with 32 possessions in a game. Now you're playing in one with 80. It is a good shot, right? And then the other one is what we talked about earlier, is I really believe in practicing context. And there's a variety of ways you can do that. But you running up and down, you say, hey, we're going to practice transition jumpers today. So we're going to go three lines and we're going to pass to each other and shoot. There's still value in that. We would do it as a warm-up and we would do it to feel good and just feel the flow of shooting quickly and out of your comfort zone. But it's way superior to put yourself in a 4-on-4 or 3-on-3 context and get up and down for 3 or 4 minutes in a dynamic way, in ways that you put the defense at a disadvantage, where you're encouraging quicker threes, right? We used to run this thing called 5-on-4 all the time, and it was continuous. We're just going and we're going and we're going. It ends up being a shooting drill, but it's a game-like shooting drill. And it ends up that you've given enough time for 3 or 4 minutes to go by, typically a TV timeout, right? Nowadays, even if it feels 30 seconds half the time, you can tell how much I love them. But when you introduce that, you've given the team enough time to make a run or respond to a run, right? We often say that basketball is a game of runs. Then we never practice runs. I never understood that, right? It was like, you're saying it's a game of runs, but then we're just practicing as if it's not. As if it's just you step here. And then the run is, oh, we stopped them once or twice and we scored once or twice. That's not much of a run to me, right? That's not a game-changing run. So you have to practice that context, and you have to practice coming back, for example. You have to practice building a lead, practice responding when your lead is gone, because everyone says, oh, they blew a lead. I'm like, not usually, right? Maybe in the last 5 to 7 minutes of a game. But if you have a 20-point lead and there's, we had one earlier this year, we had a 20-point lead and there was 30 minutes left. No, that's a, no, you don't blow a lead that way. It just, that's the way basketball works. The teams are going to come back. They're not the sisters of the poor here, man. They're, yeah, we have to learn how to respond to that without getting tight, for example. All those things are involved in, or should be involved in your practice planning. And that goes back to a point you and I have talked about before. If we're practicing for a game, then we have to really think about the context and the reality of a game, including how we switch our lineups in practice and who we put together and maybe switching it up on the fly and creating runs and doing all these different things, creating maybe confusion on defense. If we want to work on our ball screen defense, sometimes we need to create confusion. Other times they'll just say, hey, this is exactly how we want it done. No problem with that. But then there's other times it's like, all right, we want it done this way, but it's not always going to happen this way. How do we respond? How you practice is very important to that.
It makes me laugh thinking of a story exactly to that, is that I had to guest coach because one of the AU coaches wasn't there. And the girls said, are the starters starting? And literally back to your point that we have never had a consistent lineup. I don't think there have been one time over a year where we've had the same players at a tournament or at a game.
Yes.
And I just said to them, I said, who is a starter? Like, how could you possibly know who a starter is? Since literally you talk about lineup changes, but it speaks to what you just said. We need to practice with that adaptability, especially at that age, because adaptability trumps repeatability at that age, not all the time.
At every level. If ever you're going to go small where there's foul trouble, I hope we've done this in practice at some point. So guys have actually played together. That's true at every level. And that goes back to where we started today. Chris, I remember talking to a dad one time. A kid was maybe in sixth or seventh grade and it was a new team or something. Or I don't know what it was, but good little player. And he was like, this isn't a good fit. He's not able to play his game. And I said, this is a good man. And I remember saying, that is the wrong words to use with me. And I emailed him back or called him or whatever. And I said, listen, very carefully, he doesn't have a game. I didn't have a game in seventh grade. If he has a game, he's figuring out his game. You don't want him to have a game right now. Because if he has a game, one game, that's all he is for the rest of his life, right? That's a problem. I hope he can go to high school and be have one kind of game his freshman year and then develop it a little bit more sophomore year to his junior year, or senior year. So that is still true. The same kids that we have here at this high, it's Division I basketball, big stage, they're still operating with the same principles. They want to expand their game this summer, right? They want to have the freedom to try some new things in the game, knowing that they can't kill us, right? It is a high-pressure situation. You can't play to your weaknesses much, right? You got to play to your strengths, but there's a little bit of wiggle room there to be aggressive and to find that little run that you have in yourself. But yeah, who's a starter? Who's a role? You don't have it yet, right? You're not even that good. You should all be in reversible jerseys figuring stuff out. We should actually be mixing in teams right now. I said that my son had a game this Saturday. I was like, oh my gosh, like the one team, they all look like they're like 16. And I'm like, why don't we just mix in teams and play pickup, teach them how to call their own fouls. We'll save money on referees and let's get out of here. It would have been a better hour.
How about 10-year-olds that are defined as positions? Like I watched 10-year-olds in AAU that, this person always brings up the ball. Yep. I'm like, why do we care at that age? In fact, maybe the 6'2 girl should be bringing up the ball because she's likely to be a point guard when she gets older. How do we know? And everyone playing every spot and adaptability, we don't mean positionless. They can still have structure, but everyone should play different spots within the structure instead of falling into, as you said, I love that story, your game.
Yes. Yes. And then we come to this level, right? The college level, at any level of college, and kids want to know, are you flexible or do you put me in a box? Because a lot of coaches do put guys in boxes. We like to say that we give you the freedom with our help to create your own box, right? The reason people are on guard for that is because they've been on guard with that since they were in fifth or sixth grade, right? Put in a box, put in a box, put in a box. Players, they're not afraid of a role. But there's a difference between a role and then a really tight, constrained box where you can't deviate from it at all, right? You're the shooter, and if you dribble, you're in trouble. That's not really helping the shooter develop. It's also not helping the other guards develop because you know, I remember seeing youth game where, you know, the two kids who hit puberty had 40 points, and then the guards who actually were really good weren't allowed to shoot because it wasn't going to help them win the game. Well, 4 or 5 years from now, or it's probably now because it was probably 5 years from now, those same kids, if they weren't allowed to shoot, are getting cut. Their careers are over. But the ironic thing is, even at this level with transfers and freshmen, and they want to know, can I actually develop my game? If I prove to you that I can get good at something, people always ask me about player development. I'm like, the number one thing about player development is, will you allow them to do it in a game? If they get good at it, will you allow them to do it in a game? If the answer in those players' mind is no, coach will not deviate. He will not allow me to prove him wrong to a certain extent. Then he's not going to work on it. He's going to look at you like, why would I practice this? You're not letting me do this. But if you show any player, you get great at this, I'll often use that. I don't care if it's a big man popping out for three, and I don't care if you're fading away, for crying out loud. If you can make that at a 35, 36% clip, I'll let you shoot that anytime. Then all of a sudden, guys get to work. Guys get to work and kids get to work because they realize that if you allow them to expand their boundaries, they're willing to try some new things.
I can't tell you how many times this year I've told a player at a workout or practice or something like that to basically tell them to shoot the ball under the context of saying, well, I see you work on your game all the time. Why are you not then shooting the ball? Why are you working on your game if you're not going to shoot the ball? Again, somewhere along the line, a coach has constrained them to not shoot the ball when they're open.
Yep. Or worse.
Yeah.
Or worse, Chris, their parents did.
Well,
that's a whole belief I have about shooting is, you know, one of the most important things to creating a shooter is cultivating in them a higher risk tolerance, right? So like when you get the new investment bank, the new investment guy, he always gives you that questionnaire, right? Or I think I just got it from my guy of like, all right, let me just reevaluate here. You had to check, like, I'm a shooter, man. Roll the dice, baby. I don't gamble in real life. I don't go to the casino, but I go to the casino with my jumper for sure. And I'll go to the casino saying, no, I'll risk it all. Go for it. I can handle it, right? That's a high risk tolerance. It doesn't have to be, because if you're educated, the three's worth more than two. Your feet are set. Even when we talked about shot selection earlier, the other qualification we make is a good shot is not just one you practice, but it's one over which you have the most control. You control the most variables. This is an underestimated thing, because at the youth level or the high school level and any level, they go, I'm close to the basket, therefore it's good shot. No, there's three different people. There's eight different arms. There's so many variables that are coming in. And then you're at the 3-point line and you're open and your feet are set. That's got a better chance of adding up to more points than the one around the rim. That's an educational thing, right? But in terms of all those dynamics at play, it's at every level. And coaches have the opportunity to empower. And that to parents, right? I would say to parents, if you're a parent, pay attention to how much it bothers you for your kid to miss. Because if it's bothering you, you're cultivating in them a scarce, conservative mindset. And you can practice on the gun all you want. You can practice in the backyard all you want. The key to them at a young age is learning how to miss and handle it. Yeah, I lost the game. Yeah, I was 1 for 7. So what? I'm going to go out and take 8 of them next time, right? Those are the future great shooters, right? And if not, they'll come to college. They'll be great technical shooters. And then they're going to pass up a shot when they're open and then turn the ball over. And what are we doing here? That's the shot to take.
So much wisdom all the time. So much logical things that you just share with us. And that one was absolutely. And I will make sure we clip it and share it. And generally, I will say over 3 years or so of being immersed in the AAU world, parents aren't evil. I've actually had such great experiences with so many parents. And by and large, it comes back to what you mentioned earlier. A lot of them just want to understand what's going on. And I've been a conduit for that to be able to help them. And then the other thing, and maybe the last thing I'd like to get your thoughts on, one of the other things that parents do, but coaches do this too, is how often they take away decisions from players within the game, where a parent shouts from the sidelines to shoot it or pass it or do something. And I've said to those parents quite matter-of-factly, I just said, well, then come to practice and tell them what to do every second. Because right now there's a disconnect between what they're doing in practice and what they're doing in games, with you taking away decisions versus them having freedom of decisions.
We used to always say, head up. Anytime you say, get your head up, He's going to pass it and turn the ball over to the other team because he's open. He's not now. He was. You're right. He was open.
And oh, I used players to calling say, for and, the ball, right?
Yeah.
Like other and, players and, calling for the ball. Well, as soon as you call for the ball, you're alerting the defense.
Yes. Yes. You were open. Now you're not. And I used to say, and again, I always tell parents, I am not the perfect parent. I did not have my best Saturday on Saturday. I'm willing to say that for sure. All right. And I had to ask for forgiveness and say, all right, I was a little too tough on you, but, and I was probably a little bit grumpy based on the whole scene, but I'm not. So I've been guilty of anything. And that's why I'm a quick learner is like, all right, I'm the first one to say, I know how you feel because it's me. I live with myself, right? I'm a coach and a parent and a dad all at the same time. And I'm also a guy who's complaining about a lot of the stuff we're doing. So it's a deadly scenario, but I used to always say, that's your turnover. So especially parents that you know well, he's open. Yo, we're putting that turnover on you. That's your turnover, all right? Or one of my assistant coaching dads, he'd be like, get it to so-and-so, turnover. That's on you. That's not his turnover. You need to apologize to him and say, I turned the ball over on that one. I messed up there. And that's where, listen, you're right. He was open. If he doesn't see it, he didn't see it. That's the way this works. If he didn't take the shot, he didn't take the shot. We got to work with them where they are, right? Encourage them where they are. Teach aggressive mistakes as much as possible, right? Teach aggressive mistakes as much as possible. Teach them how to be people who are looking to make a play, not just looking to play it conservative, right? I think a lot of kids are being taught in school today and in life, let me just play it safe. And that doesn't work in basketball. And it definitely doesn't work if you want to get where a lot of these kids say they want to get to, right? It's not, I want to go somewhere. I want to do this thing. Yeah, you just passed up 10 open jumpers, right? And it's not going to help you win in the immediate weekend, but it will help you win the long game. And I think more importantly, from a parental perspective, like developing confident kids, developing kids who can handle failure, developing kids who can say, yeah, I messed up. I apologize, guys. I didn't help us win today. That's of more value than all the made shots in the world. And I'm guilty of forgetting that just like anybody else, but it's true.
But the environment you've created in practice, which by and large is game-based, play-based, creates opportunities for that mindset to be able to evolve naturally. Right. Sometimes you have to influence it, but a lot of times you're just getting more opportunities to develop that mindset. And if coaches take anything away from this conversation, it's that, is that the environment that you've created in your practice provides those opportunities. Whereas in the past, you and I, we could go create those opportunities on our own. Kids yep. don't have that opportunity.
But if you want to create shooters, is the one thing, last thing I'd say is reward catch and shoot shots double, triple if you have to, right? I've done it with young kids. We've done it here. We've done it at every level where it's okay. A catch and shoot is worth 5. Everything else, 2. Figure it out, gang. We want to do this. You do that for a week or two, kids are going to grow in confidence. You're going to inform their conscience. Many people, parents are a great example. Parents and coaches, right? I had an NBA coach tell me he wanted to shoot less threes. This part of my story is that I was crazy because I shot too many threes. I wasn't crazy. Everyone else was crazy, right? And I knew that. What was going on here? My high school coach had this figured out, and here I am in the NBA, and the guy's telling me he doesn't want to shoot as many threes with a 42% three-point shooter. What is this? I don't understand. I didn't have any analytics or whatever else. Our consciences are not as trustworthy as we think. So kids who have grown up a certain way, you have to retrain the brain. You have to reframe the conscience to say, yo, no, I know you've been taught this. You believe this in your bones. It's wrong. It's radically wrong. I know you missed 2 in a row. I don't care. It's still a good shot. It's going to help the team in this way and that way and this way. So you're constantly trying to teach guys and girls of any level. If you can teach them on that level, you're helping them. And eventually you're helping yourself because your team's going to be more dangerous and win.
I know it's a great conversation because anytime I try and wrap it up, we just keep going. And I love that. I absolutely love that. And obviously, Joe, we'll have to have you back on again. And it's just tremendous. And I can't wait to see you continue to evolve in your coaching career, and grateful for everything you've done to be able to share with us. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. Always enjoy following all your stuff. So keep it rolling.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and to give the Basketball Podcast and this week's guest a shout out on social media to show your support for us sharing the game. And to stay up to date on all things Basketball Immersion, subscribe to our newsletter at basketballimmersion.com/newsletter.